Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Well, the vaccine, at least the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, arrived in our little county of Santa Cruz this last week, and I was one of the lucky recipients of the first round of vaccination. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that story in just a moment. We've also got a really interesting deep dive into what you can do to make your mask work better while you're waiting for your vaccine. We're going to revisit vitamin C and its effects on pneumonia. And then we're going to dive into some really interesting emails. So I'm looking forward to the program, and I hope you'll enjoy it. So because I am a hospitalist, which means I follow my patients in the hospital, I was placed in the high priority group. And I'm extremely grateful for that because over the last year, as I've gone into the hospital and taken all of my precautions and, you know, cleaned off my shoes before getting into the car and all of the things, it's a creeping thing in the back of your head. It's very similar. Women will get this. I think men will too, but women will get this if you're walking in a kind of deserted or just a dark area or a dark street and someone with heavy footsteps is walking behind you. There's a little creepy feeling that you get between your shoulder blades, or at least most of us who aren't black belts in karate get. And that's the feeling of being a hospitalist in the time of COVID. And I am very happy, not that I've got any immunity yet. I mean, we're only, 5 days out. But I thought you'd like to know about the process. So it's by appointment, and the doctors, of course, are all socially distanced. They go through a fairly complicated registration and release process because this is still an EUA. And I just want to compliment the staff, the administration at Dominican for just a very thorough, professional setup that they've created where we can get our vaccine and be very safe and also just hang out socially distanced in a hallway for a little while after the vaccine to make sure that none of us have a bad reaction. They thought of everything, and they did a really good job. I also learned that there is a vaccine tracking app that now talks to me every morning and tells me to please tell it about the symptoms. And so they're crowdsourcing, effectively, from the people who get vaccinated, a lot of good information. So we can expect as the other vaccines roll out that this will also happen. So by the time your number is up, folks, you're going to have that data that's reassuring. You're going to have at least a lot of information about short-term side effects. Long-term side effects? Well, as you might surmise, that's going to require the long-term. If you are interested in seeing some photos of the process, I have been tweeting those things at Ask Dr. Dawn. I do have a little Twitter account. You can go and look me up and take a look at a couple of tweets, including me and my smiling face getting my vaccine. Just thought I'd share that. I want to encourage people not to be afraid of this. And we'll be having some conversations about vaccine hesitancy based on what's been going on in one of the emails we got. I also want to comment on my symptoms. So my arm was sore pretty quickly, I would say within an hour or so. Ordinarily with a flu vaccine, there is no persistent symptom. With this, there definitely was soreness, and it began ramping up. Couldn't sleep on that side that night. That was a sore shoulder. It's got a little tendonitis. And oddly enough, the inflammation from the vaccine actually made my tendonitis a lot better. And that's how the body works, because when you create inflammation, you also create the release of anti-inflammatory cytokines, right? We've talked about this yin-yang thing. And there's a delay switch. So the anti-inflammatory cytokines don't come on board as quickly. The inflammatory ones do. You get a burst of inflammation, and then you get the fire trucks arrive and hose down the fire. So in this case, the vaccine was actually curative, or at least helpful, for my little low-grade chronic tendinitis. The following day, which was Saturday, I began feeling just tired, a little bit under the weather. I noticed that my neck and back were achy, not badly. It didn't interfere with me doing anything. I just really didn't feel like doing all that much. I went and took a long, hot Epsom salt bath and sweated. And that's my favorite thing when I think I'm coming down with something. In other words, I sweat out my extra cytokines, and I generally feel a lot better once I do that. And it worked like a charm, as it usually does for me. So, a few helpful hints. As far as the last comment, I want to just tell you how brave and how kind the people at Dominican Hospital are being. I'm seeing it every day that I go in there. I have a patient in there right now. And, you know, COVID brings out the best and the worst in people. And if you're a healer, if you went into this profession for the right reasons, then it brings out the best of you. And it just makes us have an esprit de corps, a sense of being, you know, on the same team that's not always present under ordinary circumstances. So let's move to the mask study. This was a study done and published on December 10th. And you can find it. You probably do want to find it. I'm going to talk about it at some length, but there's some wonderful pictures. And when I talk about the rubber band fix, you're going to need to see a picture of that, or at least I did, to get the gist. But the rubber band fix turns out to be a remarkable way to improve the efficacy of your mask. So I want to be sure that you get this. So let's start with the study itself. I want to describe the setup, first of all. A particle generator was used to supplement a chamber, a closed, custom-built exposure chamber. And they put sodium chloride particles into the air. The medium diameter of the particles was in the 0.05 micron, so exactly what we'd like to be filtering out when we're talking about this virus. And they put a lot of essentially aerosolized saline into the air and let it kind of sit there and stabilize and blend with itself for about 30 minutes. And then they put a guy in there. In each case, the guy was wearing a different mask, or a different kind of mask, or the same kind of mask with different ear loop arrangements. And more about that in a moment. Inside each of these masks, there was a sampling port that would measure what was getting through the mask. And being scientists, of course, we know from the methods section, always read the methods section, by the way, that the man weighed 165.3 pounds, was 5 feet 10.1 inches, and had a head size of 23 inches with no beard. They also monitored the particle in the room, and then they set up a ratio. This ratio is called the FFE, and it's just what is used for testing respirators. It's basically the concentration of particles behind the mask expressed as a percentage of the particle concentrates in the air. So it's the amount of particles that get through. So the math is actually, it's reciprocal. So you take 100 times 1 minus the behind the particle concentration, and then you divide that by the ambient particle concentration. The larger the number, the better the filter. They left the guy in there for 3 minutes, and then they did the analysis. So here are the masks that were tested. You've seen them all out there. A 2-layer woven nylon mask with ear loops. This was a little bit stretchy, but not a lot stretchy. It did a bandana folded diagonally and worn bandit style, or worn in a multi-layer rectangle, and that was something that the Surgeon General recommended, a single-layer woven polyester nylon mask, a polypropylene mask, basically something that's a little bit like thin wetsuit material, a single-layer gaiter, kind of baklava bandana thing. I see those for sale on Pinterest all the time, and a three-layer woven cotton mask. They also used surgical procedure masks, and they played with the strings. And I want to talk about this because I've seen that those surgical procedure masks are pretty widely available now, and they do have decent filtration. They get way, way better, almost to N95 level, if you're willing to look silly. And, of course, you could look silly and then cover that up with a lightweight fabric mask, and no one would know that you looked silly if you care about that. All right, here are the things they did. They enhanced the mask feel by tying the ear loops to make them tighter and tucking in the side loops. They also fastened the ear loops behind the head with a kind of 3D hook, but you could do any kind of hook. They used a claw hair clip, you know, the kind that it's called a lobster claw, and women use it to just hold their hair up. Oh, and by the way, that was a 23-millimeter claw-type hair clip, so let's be clear here. 23 millimeters is about an inch long. They placed a ring of three gauged rubber bands over the mask with the center rubber band placed over the nose and chin. And then on either side, there was another rubber band that looped over the ear. So it kind of gave you a chimpanzee profile. And it was very, very interesting to see the effects on this. I'm going to cut to the chase here and say that the surgical mask was really not significantly better than the commercial things that you could buy off the rack. In fact, the two-layer nylon with a non-woven insert was actually pretty darn good. If you have the aluminum nasal bridge and the insert, you got about a 74%. And here's something interesting. Once it was washed, it actually got a little better. I guess the nylon fibers swelled or something, but that was good to know. And the surgical mask was not all that great initially. It was 71%. Now, remember, we're talking about 98 to 100% with the NIOSH. So surgical mask is, with ties, 71%. Surgical mask with just the procedure mask, they call it, with ear loops, 38%. Tuck it in, pull the straps tight, use the claw clip. Well, you got it up to 64%. Use the three rubber bands. You get it up to 78%. Oh, and I left one out. Nylon stocking, bank robber style, except you just cut it off so it's a tube. It doesn't have to go over your head or your eyes. But the bank robber nylon stocking got it up to 80%, which is really, really pretty decent. So the fit the mask, 78%. The nylon hosiery, a lot easier. Still looks kind of silly, but you know what? So what? I think that this study was done very credibly. I think it gives us useful information, and I hope you'll agree. So we're going to talk now about vitamin C, as promised. Some of you may remember, oh gosh, it seems like forever. It was really just at the beginning of the summer. We did an interview about the MATH protocol, and the MATH protocol included methylprednisolone, which is a steroid. This is before using Decadron became the standard. Ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C, thiamine, and heparin. So heparin for the blood clots, thiamine, well, I guess just because, and high-dose vitamin C, 6 grams every 4 hours, was a protocol that these guys came up with and were promoting. Very decent scientific data. We're going to take a little deeper dive on one of those components, which is, what's the data tell us about IV vitamin C, and in fact, oral vitamin C, when it comes to infections? Well, here's a little bit of information. What's this thing about vitamin C anyway? You know, most animals make their own vitamin C. You know, pigs don't make it. Most bats don't make it, which I thought was interesting. But almost all animals can make vitamin C. Fish, just about everybody else, but not primates and not guinea pigs and not bats. Why? Well, because they eat a lot of citrus. So somewhere along the way, the enzyme to make vitamin C got lost. And so gorillas, they eat mostly fruits and vegetables. So they get about 5 grams of vitamin C a day. Now, the average requirement for us to avoid scurvy is about 80 milligrams a day. That'll keep our plasma level at 50, which is probably decent, but under physiologic stress, you probably need at least 200. And if you're over 65 or older, you probably should be taking 200. Linus Pauling, of course, says 400 milligrams if you're over 50 years old. But Linus Pauling Institute always wants you to take high doses of vitamin C. What the data shows us, however, is when you have a viral infection, if you're trying to hold your plasma level between 60 and 80, which is the sweet spot, you have to take more. You have to take 2 to 3 grams a day. And would this be helpful? Well, there's a prospective study that looked at vitamin C levels in the blood of individuals. And this was a prospective study, so there wasn't a look back. They looked at 20,000 people over 20 years and found that those who were in the top 25% of vitamin C level had a 30% lower risk of pneumonia. And oral vitamin C in people who had low dietary intakes caused a reduction in the risk of pneumonia. So this was a large enough study that they could say that. Now, in severe COVID-19, we're seeing an organizing pneumonia in most of the people who die from this. There was a recent study looking at pneumonia in patients with healthy controls. And basically, if you have low vitamin C, and we would define that for our purposes as below 50, you will have a higher risk of pneumonia. And it appears that, of course, the longer you spend in the ICU, folks, guess what? Your vitamin C levels plummet because when you're sick, your immune system uses up your vitamin C. It chews through it. So even if you come into the hospital with normal vitamin C, you're not going to have normal vitamin C at the end. And vitamin C seems to do a lot of good things. It helps speed up the development of T cells. It improves phagocytosis and chemotaxis. In other words, they scoot around faster and they chew faster and they chew up more stuff. The phagocytes actually use up and try to regenerate some of the oxidized vitamin C, which is great. And of course, that's one of the things vitamin C does, is it allows itself to be oxidized. So if you get oxidative species sitting around in the tissue, like the lungs, you get more inflammation. Oxidative free radicals increase inflammation. You get more of that tumor necrosis factor alpha and more of that interleukin 1 beta, both of which, if you are familiar with the alphabet soup of COVID, will recognize as things that get very, very high and are associated with the cytokine storm. Vitamin C is also an epigenetic factor. It upregulates antioxidant proteins and downregulates the pro-inflammatory cytokines. So at the moment, we are thinking that the more ACE receptors you've got, the more vulnerable you are. And that's what explains why diabetics and people with hypertension have higher infectious rates and get more virus in their systems. But we should point out that vitamin C abolishes some of that angiotensin converting enzyme type 2 upregulation all by itself. So it's fighting the things that are making you more vulnerable. So if you have risk factors, you know, at this point, I said it way back at the beginning, but I just want to emphasize it again. This is a safe and benign intervention. A couple thousand milligrams of vitamin C will completely not hurt you and may be extremely helpful in protecting you. So there's a whole lot of good data here. This paper was published in a journal called Nutrients, and I'm going to post, published in December of this year, So 7 December 2020, the Journal of Nutrients will go ahead and put a link up in the resources page for a couple weeks just to allow you to get there. We're moving to our first email now. And that comes from Anne in New Jersey. Morning sickness drugs. Thanks for your excellent podcast, which I've loved for many years. I'd like to ask you for suggestions on dealing with preventing nausea most of the day during pregnancy and first trimester, vomiting only sometimes, but unable to eat due to constant nausea. Well, there's a very safe thing. There's an agent that I really like. You can make this up yourself. It's grated raw ginger. You want to have a lot of that. You can put it in honey and kind of saturate the honey and then take a couple of teaspoons when you're starting to feel nausea. And that's this. There's no way you can overdose on this. There's an over-the-counter compound that's very old called emetrol, E-M-M-E-T-R-O-L, that I used to use all the time before I found the ginger, which I think works better. Following with the questions, do you consider the B6 Unisom combination, which is 25 milligrams of B6 three times a day and one Unisom at bedtime, do you think that's safe? OBGYN said it was okay. C-band bracelets are of marginal help. So I think that the B6 Unisom combination is probably okay. B6, I'm certainly not worried about. And the Unisom is, there's two different versions of Unisom, but the one that I think your OBGYN approved was the one that has diphenhydramine, D-I-P-H-E-N, in it. And diphenhydramine is Benadryl, causes, and it's an anti-nausea drug. It's a reasonable one to use. It's used to help people sleep because it makes you sleepy. And you may not enjoy that effect, but you can see how it works for you. And I do not think it will hurt your baby even in the first trimester. As a second question, Anne continues, can I ask your opinion on the COVID-19 vaccine for pregnant women? That is a really excellent question. Ordinarily, what we do is we try not to give a pregnant woman any new or experimental drug unless the benefit outweighs the risk. So we're going to work through a little risk-benefit analysis, and I have some fun facts about neonatal development just to spice up the mix. First of all, you have to ask yourself, as a pregnant woman, what are your odds of getting COVID? For example, many women might not be able to isolate because they have to work, because they are in a situation where they don't have any other option. And if you're out there working with the public while pregnant, then that really gives you high odds of getting COVID. And I think we want to get you vaccinated if that's the situation, but I'd much rather that you were sheltering and not being exposed. So perhaps that might mean moving in with a family member. I don't know your personal circumstances, but essentially, if you're going to get COVID, and we'll talk about that in a moment, it matters what trimester. It also matters what your morbidity is. In other words, are you asthmatic? Do you have diabetes? Under those circumstances, your risk of bad COVID is higher. And the higher the virus count gets, the more potential for causing the problems of pregnancy. And we're going to talk about what problems we know about, always wanting to emphasize that there's a lot, a very great deal that we don't know. So what happens during the first, second, and third trimester? Basically, the first trimester starts out with a single fertilized egg, which then reproduces, forms a ball, flattens out, and then curves on itself. And at that point, you're forming various layers, and you start to look a little bit like a flatworm. And the flatworm has cells that are going to be the spinal cord, cells that are going to be the brain, cells that are going to be the liver, kidneys, etc. But by looking, you couldn't tell. As the trimester goes on, you start to form the proto-organs. In other words, these pluripotent embryonic stem cells are no longer pluripotent. They start to make a commitment. I'm going to be a liver cell. I'm going to be a muscle cell. I'm going to be a heart cell. And they start migrating to the locations on the now established up, down, front, back of the flatworm to where they're going to grow and develop. And that migration, we'll come to in a moment, is extremely important. And if anything interferes with that migration, you've got a problem. So by the end of the first trimester, you've formed all of the organs. They don't look anything like the organs, but they're there. And if you lose tissue from that area at that moment, you're probably going to end up with a birth defect in that organ. All right. So the second trimester, we all heave a sigh of relief. That's at 12 weeks around, because now you've formed those organs. So drugs get a lot safer at this point. Most of the drugs that we know cause real problems, we know cause in the first trimester. The second trimester is about elaboration of the structures of all of these things. That's where you go from looking like a flatworm to looking like an embryonic pig. And indeed, if you look at an image of an embryonic pig and an embryonic human, it's really hard to tell the difference. The third trimester is all about growth. And this is growth of the brain is happening hugely during this part. And blood supply during the third trimester becomes extremely important. So when we ask ourselves, do we have a natural experiment? We do actually have a natural experiment, because it's more than 9 months since the first cases of COVID-19 in China happened. And so we have a study that was published in July that looked at a retrospective of 29 pregnant women who got COVID, and 14 of them had mild symptoms. None of them got very sick. They were all young women. The average age was 29. 15 had no symptoms. 11 of the 29 had pregnancy complications, which is very interesting. Let's see, about 27 had cesarean, so it may increase your risk of cesarean. The pregnancy complications are not specified in the paper, but we definitely need to look at that and see whether there's any pattern there as more numbers accumulate. About half of the babies needed to be admitted, 18 out of 30, so a little more than half. And of those, most of them had pneumonia. There were a couple that actually had COVID-19, which means presumably, although we don't know for sure, presumably they got it from the mother prior to birth, which is an interesting question. But there are periods, and one of them is during labor, when the blood of the baby and the mother can directly mix. And I suspect that that's what was going on. So they did find, as I said, that several of the babies were proven to have antibody to COVID. And we don't know if that could have been mom's antibody or it was their own antibody. This study was not that sophisticated. We have a few other studies that I think are worth mentioning. One of them looked at the placentas of the pregnant women. And the placentas had a lot of blood clots. So normally you can see blood clots in placentas after birth. We call it the afterbirth, and we always look at it because if the placenta looks wonky, like it didn't develop right, then you have to worry about internal birth defects in the fetus. Under normal circumstances, about 10% of placentas have clots. In COVID cases, 50% have been reported as the number. So we now know that occult COVID, or even overt COVID during pregnancy, particularly in the third trimester, may be a reason for fetal growth retardation. And I think if we see a baby who's not growing as quickly as we should be looking for COVID antibodies in the mom. The interesting thing about the placenta and first trimester pregnancies, and this is, of course, Anne's situation, is COVID does not actually seem to be getting in to babies in the first trimester. I mentioned that that's when organs form and migrate. The poster child here is thalidomide. And those of you who are old enough will remember about thalidomide. It was a terrible disease. And what happened in that circumstance was that women took this drug for insomnia during pregnancy. Those that took it during the first trimester interfered with the migration of the vessels into the limb buds. So essentially, the arms and legs didn't get big enough blood vessels, so they were stunted, very stunted, sometimes so stunted that the babies had hands growing out of their shoulders. And of course, this was a widely used in Europe, so there were a lot of deformed babies that were born, not so widely used in this country. And therein hangs a tale, which I'm not going to get into right now. And we have Zika, we have rubella. So we know that certain infections in the first trimester can cross the placenta. And it's the ones that get into the bloodstream that cross the placenta that cause birth defects, usually because the mother gets them in the first trimester. COVID doesn't cross the placenta, although it does seem to get stuck there. And of course, the blood clots don't have to be COVID, right? They can be from the blood being procoagulant, and we know that's a feature of this infection. The placenta actually can't get infected very easily with COVID because it doesn't make the angiotensin converting enzyme 2 receptor, and it doesn't make the furan or the TMPRSS2 enzyme, which also has to be present for COVID to be infectious. So before I leave the subject, I just want to point out that while thalidomide is used for various diseases, including, oddly enough, in leprosy and inflammatory bowel disease, we have to be very careful that these women don't become pregnant. But a drug that is given often to women in their period of fertility that is much worse for causing birth defects is Accutane. And Accutane is, sadly, given far more readily than it should be. And if you take thalidomide in your first trimester, you have a 1 out of 5 chance of having birth defects in the baby. If you take Accutane in your first trimester, the number is closer to 1 in 3. So that's an extremely nasty drug. And really, anybody who could get pregnant, in other words, people with uteruses, probably should think twice before resorting to taking that agent. All right, our next email comes from John in St. Louis. Subject, wait for AstraZeneca vaccine? Hi, Dr. Don. I'm so glad you mentioned on a previous show that the AstraZeneca Oxford University vaccine was more of a conventional vaccine, with the inactivated virus being injected into the body. While the RNA technology on the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines is exciting and holds lots of promise, I've never been excited about taking a brand new medication. I'm not an anti-vaccine person with conventional ones, and I advise my acupuncture patients that conventional vaccines have been proven to be safe and that they should read the science, not the anti-vax celebrities. I am one of the groups getting the vaccine very late in the process, maybe in summer, so it wouldn't be a hardship to wait for the AstraZeneca vaccine to be approved. Is there any wisdom in waiting? Thanks so much. Your show is a tremendous resource for all listeners. Yes, indeed, the AstraZeneca vaccine will probably be here well before June. It has already been submitted for approval in the UK. And of course, that's the AstraZeneca/Oxford University vaccine. So it's probably going to get approved. The safety data is similar to the data that we've already received, although there have been a couple of hiccups during the initial phase 3 studies. It is looking pretty good from a safety standpoint. From an effectiveness standpoint, it falls behind the mRNA vaccines, but I think that may actually change. So overall, in the phase 3 studies, it was 62% effective. And I think I covered this briefly earlier, but there was an error in the methods in one subgroup where they gave people a half-strength dose initially and ended up giving them a full dose at the, I think it's 3 week margin for the follow-up shot. So far, everything we've got is two shots. And that group had 90% effectiveness. So if that pans out, it may be a serendipitous thing that they discovered that a small dose, then a big double dose, effectively, gives you a better take. This vaccine indeed uses a replication-defective chimpanzee adenovirus. In other words, it's a chimpanzee cold, and it's been sterilized, basically. It is not able to reproduce the reproductive structures or the ability to build a competent infectious virus have been edited out of the virus itself, but it does contain, edited in, the gene for the SARS-CoV spike glycoprotein. So essentially this virus hits, bumps up against a cell, fuses with it, dumps its payload into the inside of the cell, and the payload starts getting transcribed, including the SARS-CoV spike protein. And that spike protein then alerts the immune system, and the immune system starts making antibody. I, too, would be more comfortable taking something that has a proven track record if it had the same efficacy. And so if on subsequent evaluation the AZ turns out to also be 90% effective, then I think waiting for it makes a lot of sense. Although, given the supply issues, I'm not sure that we're any of us going to have that much choice about which vaccine we're offered, because we're going to have to spread this over a very large group of people. As you know, this is a big country. And it may make more sense, since you are that acupuncturist and work with the public, to go with the most efficacious vaccine. So if it's still at 62%, I'm not so sure that I wouldn't go with the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine because of your occupation. You're in a closed, small exam room with people, and you're going in and out. And so you're picking up potentially a amount of virus, even if you're masked, that could be problematic and expose you. Your home circumstances also make a difference. If you have teenagers or college-age kids, if you have people who might come back and live with you because their university gets shut down because of an outbreak in March, or even, God knows, let's hope not. But we're probably going to be stamping out outbreaks in lots of places because, unfortunately, I think there's a lot of people out there who will refuse vaccination because of beliefs or values that they hold, which, you know, the thing about this is it's really about beliefs and values. We're moving on to an email from Fred in Bradley, California. Subject: reply to 1213 podcast request. You asked for views about vaccination. Yes, Fred, thank you very much for getting back to me. And what Fred's done here is he's given me the voice of someone who is anti-vaccine. And so let's hear what Fred has to say. Well, all you vaccinated people should have no problem with us unvaccinated folks, because if the vaccine works, you won't have to worry about us getting you sick. Us unvaccinated people will be the healthier ones, because we will not have the toxins in our bodies and will not be living in fear, which completely makes one sick. Meanwhile, y'all with the vaccine will be reenacting Night of the Living Dead, as you will be zombies controlled by the metals in your bodies. Let me know before you get the vaccine, as I would like to say goodbye to the version of you that I know. And it goes downhill from here, says Fred. By the way, there is no way to change the opinions of people who imagine they don't appear to think very deeply this way. I followed the discussion on the web. It just got crazier and crazier. Cheers, Fred, Fix Pain author. Fix Pain is a book that I actually really like, Fred, so nice to know that you're a listener. Now, on Friday, I heard a very interesting discussion. It was a webinar. It lasted about 4 hours, and it was from the American Academy of Sciences. There were a lot of talks about vaccine hesitancy, how that's evolved over time since we now have a vaccine. It's dropped quite a bit. I think that some of the efforts that Fauci and others have made to reassure people that while it's gone through the phase three quickly, they haven't cut any corners on the phase three. Our major problem really, and this is me being parenthetical, is long-term, we know nothing because we can't. There hasn't been a long-term yet. And that's just how it is. That's true of the AstraZeneca as well. We don't know how long it will last. We don't know about a lot of things. You've heard them all. I'm not going to rework them here. But the most interesting of the speakers was a woman who talked about forgetting about making the conversation about information, forgetting about making the conversation about facts, that wasn't what we needed to be doing. Because as you point out, you aren't going to change the opinions of people about facts. What she did was she talked about what are the common values or what are the common beliefs, not facts, but beliefs. And one of the threads that you mentioned here, fear of contamination. Another one I hear in the paragraph that Fred wrote is fear of being controlled, fear of losing self-determination and being controlled by something outside of yourself. Fear of contamination, maybe a little bit of original sin. My body is a temple. It's pure. I don't want something impure put into it. But let's say that was the argument. Then you might ask the person about smoking, about their diet, about fast food, about other impurities that they might actually be putting into their body without really thinking it through. You're not going to persuade them to get vaccinated, but you may get them thinking and they may persuade themselves. You have to reframe the argument. Another question, probably the first one I will be asking when I have this conversation next, is what are the things that are important to you that COVID-19 has taken away from you? What are your losses? Because when you frame it as gains, you get past the, well, I'm fine, I'll just get a cold, it'll just be a flu. Well, I'll be okay. And you change it into something else. You can reframe it as patriotism. I'm not doing this for I'm not going to get much out of this. I'm young and I'm healthy. But what I am going to get is helping others. Defending is the verb I would use. If you're called upon to defend the weak, are you going to refuse because you're strong and you don't need to defend anybody else? So that's how the conversation needs to go. You need to get people thinking actually for themselves and thinking about what their values are and how those values are reflected by their behavior in this extremely difficult time. Our next email comes from Rebecca in Sunnyvale. LED treatment eye safety. Dear Dr. Don, I recently tried an at-home LED facial mask with options for either red, blue, or green light therapy. The mask has holes for the eyes and came with black eye covers. Despite using the eye covers, which are effective at blocking the room light, the LED colored lights from the mask could still be seen. Is there any reason to be concerned about long-term eye damage? And Rebecca, I really do not think so. But your question made me think about light therapy in general and laser therapy. And so we're going to, first of all, say that make some differentiations. Visible spectrum versus ultraviolet. Now, we all know that ultraviolet radiation is dangerous, right? It can cause sunburn and can also damage the vision. So staring directly at the sun, you can permanently damage your retina. Your retina acts like your lens, acts like a magnifying glass, and you can burn a hole in your retina. But UVC light that a lot of people are using for sterilization now, that also can damage your skin and the skin at the back of your eyeball. Visible spectrum light, of course, is what that eyeball is designed to handle. And you have vitamin A molecule-based antioxidants in your eyeball that have been repurposed as sensors, but they are, in fact, also designed to be able to absorb energy in a way that doesn't cause them to be damaged themselves, up to a point, of course. Now, laser light and the LED light are very, very different. Even though that LED light looks red or blue or green, it's made up of multiple wavelengths of light. And those wavelengths are not lined up with each other. So essentially what you've got there is a blurry flashlight. And it's low energy. So why does it work? Low energy lasers, which was how this light therapy was originally developed, have given way to LEDs, which are cheaper and safer. I found myself wondering, how is it that light works? And I discovered something. The sensor for light is actually the mitochondria in every cell of your body. And the ones on the surface of your body, the skin, the light will penetrate a few millimeters into your skin. Well, they have these compounds called cytochromes. Cytochromes are part of the oxidative phosphorylation process, the process that makes ATP itself. And with the little electrons bouncing around, it turns out that photons as well, they'll be absorbed by the cytochromes as well. And so you are literally using kind of a flashlight Morse code right now to try and turn on collagen production and reduce inflammation in your skin. And different lights do, in fact, have different properties. I remember when I was first studying acupuncture, listening to an article about just using colored dots on children because they are so responsive, you don't want to needle them. But you could put just a colored dot, and the light coming through the red pigment on the colored dot would essentially send light into the skin of the child. So blue light's anti-inflammatory, red light is stimulatory, and you can actually have an effect, particularly if you put that light in an acupuncture point. Low-energy lasers penetrate more deeply. Essentially, if you have one of those flashlights that you can focus the beam, so it can either be kind of broad light to see your way down the steps or bright light to see something off in the distance that's making noise in the trees, well, think of the laser as the focused flashlight and the diffuse as the LED. So I'll explore this idea of cellular signaling with light a bit more. I'm fascinated with it, and I'll probably get back to you at some point with a science lesson on the topic because I'm blown away by the idea that our mitochondria, that light from the sun as far as that goes, but light from colored emitters is actually a way of talking via semaphore to our cells. It's fascinating and amazing, and I need to know more. So maybe in a month or two after we get over the current hump. Our last email probably for tonight is from Mary in Truckee. Dear Dr. Don, one of my friends recommends a Beamer machine. That stands, by the way, for bioelectric magnetic energy regulation. For general blood flow, oxygen supply, waste disposal, endurance, strength, and energy. I'm wondering if this even works. What's your opinion? On the pamphlet, it states it's FDA registered as a medical device, featured in over 50 medical publications, and used in more than 4,500 medical clinics, hospitals, and universities. And it's about $5,000. So what do you think about this? Well, Mary, I think that it's still a bit controversial, and I'm not sure that you couldn't achieve the same results with a substantially lower cost. I believe that mostly what you're getting with a Beamer is similar to the effect that you get with acupuncture. And while I haven't studied it, possibly laser acupuncture would also do the same thing. The thing that bothers me about this is that you've got that electromagnetic energy. This is basically an EMF generating device, and you are going to bathe yourself in some extra EMF as a side effect of this. And at the same conference where I first learned about the Beamer, I heard a lecture by a woman named Deborah Davis, that's D-E-V-R-A. You should check out her TED Talk to get the gist of what she's saying. But we were talking about the mitochondria and the cytochromes just a moment ago. Well, EMF can also go through the mitochondria, But as it goes through the mitochondria, it actually makes them temporarily leaky, and you lose some of the effectiveness of that oxidative phosphorylation. And this has been established in studies done on EMF and sperm. So listen to the TED Talk if you're interested. I've never really felt comfortable with the Beamer because of the fact this lecturer was right up there on the podium, followed by someone extolling the virtues of the Beamer for treatment of pain. There's a couple of other devices. There's a pair of gloves that you can put on and then stroke the person, and that's another EMF device that was promoted. I forget the name of that one. But as an acupuncturist, I've always figured that I might as well just get out my needles, so I never explored it further. But I know that it's nice if you want to make money, because you can buy this machine and put an untrained technician on it and go off and see other patients, and you essentially will get paid for, and you've got quote-unquote passive income, which is the holy grail of a lot of people, myself not included. I like the hands-on approach. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay healthy, and I'll see you next week.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.